So what I'm going to talk about is some primarily numerical work we've done on looking at dynamo level implementations of quantum loop gases, also together with Johnson Devoy, postdoc, who's been very important in writing or helping to write our Monte Carlo simulation codes for this. So what I'm going to do today is, first of all, I'll give I'll try to make this quick, a summary of the deisotopic quantum loop gas behavior and the dynamo model implementations. I've been a lot of that this week already, so I'll go through that fast. Then I'll focus on the generalized RK points of dynamo models. And one, this has also been mentioned earlier this week, original work by Chris Henley showed that one can generalize the RK point of a dynamo model and make then a classical quantum translation to enable one to use classical Monte Carlo techniques to make calculations for ground excited states. And then I'll present some calculations we've done with this system, these kind of systems on a triangular lattice. And that uses as its point of departure the proposal of Friedman, Nyack, and Stengel for a quantum loop gas on a triangular lattice, which has an approximation on the surrounding Kagame lattice of an extended Hubbard Hamiltonian, which is very attractive because it only has two-body interactions. And so most of the calculations I'm going to talk about are to do with the dynamo model implementation of this. And in the last few minutes, I'll talk a little bit about some work we've been done in terms of developing a scheme to realize this extended Hubbard Hamiltonian now on the surrounding Kagame lattice with trapped atoms and molecules. Okay, so first of all, so as everyone here knows, that certain quantum loop gas models sit on quantum critical points that are related to class monomedian topological phases. And this is one set of exotic phases that receive a lot of value by studying our lattice models. Another one is the string net models. We're going to focus on the loop gas models and lattice realization of these. Okay, so the deisotopic quantum loop gases are, so here's a brief summary of their properties. So it's a Hilbert space with closed non-intersecting loops and configurations related by isotopy relations given equal weight, whereas configurations which are related by the addition of a contractible loop, such as this small loop here, which can be swallowed up into this larger loop, are given a relative weight of a parameter D, which is the deisotopy parameter here. Now, the ground state of this system is given exactly by a superposition over all covering loops, where each is weighted by this factor D to the power of the number of loops in the configuration. And then the norm of the norm squared of the ground state wave function is equivalent to the partition function of a classical model. And again, this was discussed earlier in the week. Both the POS model and the order N model have partition functions equal to the square of the norm of this wave function. Then, in addition, the deisotopic quantum loop gas in this range of parameters of D, 1 to root 2, was shown by Friedman and Stengel to live on a critical line with speculated or conjectured gapless k squared excitations. Okay, so, this is all that's known. And in addition, it's not only the only things that are known. So in addition, this critical line was conjectured to be an SU2 analog of the U1 gauge theory that's seen at the RK point on bipartite lattices. So just as a reminder, here is a square lattice. This is some random loop configuration on the square lattice. This is the quantum dimer Hamiltonian on the square lattice, and the Roxar Kibble point is the point at which the amplitude V and T are equal. And that defines this point on bipartite lattice. It's a single point here, and it separates an ordered stagger phase from Paquette phase. And so on the deisotopic loop gases, So the critical line is supposed to be the SV2 analog of this single critical point on bipartite lattices. Now, on non-bipartite lattices, such as the triangular lattice, an even more interesting situation for us arises because the RK point there, which is here, is adjacent to a topological phase which is described by Z2 gauge theory. Right. So this is one reference point for us, the RK point on a non-bipartite lattice because of its proximity to the topological phases which exist in the RK systems are located here in the RVD phase. Then furthermore, the de-isotopic condition is related to the Wilson loop algebra of the Chan-Simons series, and that gives us a relationship between D and K. Okay, so what we want to investigate are ultimately the conditions, macroscopic conditions for existence of such proximate phases of related topological order. And we're doing that by investigating the Coulomb loop gases on a lattice. And so our starting point is summarized here. We're going to treat the de-isotopic Coulomb loop gases as generalized RK points. They're generalized in the sense of Henle, namely that the square norm of the gas state wave function is equivalent to a partition function of some classical model. You can take them any classical model. The exact ground state is a superposition then corresponds to a superposition of classical-like configurations. In our case, those classical configurations will be dynamo loop coupled to the lattice. Each classical configuration is weighted by the square root of some pseudo-Boltzmann weight. So the temperature here is like a Boltzmann weight of a corresponding classical model. And that point may be either an isolated quantum critical point, as for a bipartite lattice, or adjacent to a related phase, which we hope will turn out to be topological phase for the triangular lattice. So our strategy is then summarized here. But first we're going to characterize the ground state and excitations of these de-isotopic quantum loop gases at these generalized RK points on lattices. And this, as I mentioned, and I'll show you in more detail, can be done with classical Monte Carlo techniques. And most of, in fact, nearly everything I'll show you in terms of numerical results this morning is basically results at this point. Our general program is then to, once we've completed this, which we're basically still in the middle of, to look at the effects then of perturbations, such as, for instance, surgeries between loops, breaking and closing loops, and to look for the opening of gaps and analyze the nature of excitations in the system. And for this, we have to use quantum Monte Carlo. I won't talk about it today, but I think we can talk about it. We basically have most of this already written. We just haven't yet got some results for this yet. And then lastly, the appendix, if you like, to what the main results I'm going to show you today is part of a more general program where we're trying to use this, we're trying to investigate this extended Hubbard Hamiltonian. So we're going to focus in our lattice calculations on a diamond Hamiltonian on a triangular lattice, which has this relationship to an extended Hubbard Hamiltonian approximation on the Kangami lattice. Again, which is a very nice representation because it has two-body interactions, is restricted to two-body interactions. Okay, so now let me tell you about this very nice procedure for extracting essentially quantum dynamics, or at least excited states, and certainly ground states from classical Monte Carlo methods. Okay, this is due to Henle, who pointed out that if one has an RK type Hamiltonian, so we know the RK point is defined as when V equals T, but we can generalize this to at that point, it's known that the ground state, the norm of the ground state wave function, is related to a classical partition function. So Henle noted that this can be generalized to a case where one has some other partition function, and he originally said, well, how about a finite temperature partition function like this, where we have a factor 1 over T weighting the classical energies, and then one has, is there some way we can, do I have to talk faster? Get through every slide? All right. Okay, so so then one has a corresponding transformed effective Hamiltonian, and the exact zero energy ground states of this would be similar superposition over all loop configurations, where these are now weighted though by this corresponding analog of a classical Boltzmann factor. Okay, in our case, we're going to make the translation of this to d to the power n, where n is the number of loops. Okay, so in order to investigate the ground Linux factor states from this, one basically looks at the classical system and investigates this with the master equation. And the master equation tells us the rate of change of all the different configurations probabilistically. And this can be done simply with metropolis sampling according to this acceptance probability, where we're just comparing the energies, or the pseudo-Boltzmann factors, of configurations alpha and beta. Okay, we have to satisfy a conservation of probability here. So then if we take this W from the original RK point, make a similarity transformation according to these now generalized weights, or pseudo-Boltzmann weights, then we obtain an effective rate equation, rate matrix, which gives us the transformed RK Hamiltonian, and that is precisely our Diamond Hamiltonian. So this is precisely the quantum Diamond Hamiltonian that we're using. So we're going to go then backwards in this direction and construct an effective classical rate equation. And then it's fairly straightforward to show that the eigenvalues of the classical master equation are proportional to the eigenvalues of the quantum Hamiltonian, and in that case, one can get the excited states, but also, even before one does that, it's very simple then to just sample the classical model related to the quantum ground state according to metropolis sampling, and one essentially is sampling the quantum ground state. So what I'm going to show you this morning are results, essentially at this level. Now, in addition, we have this working, but we haven't...
There's no sign problem at all with this class of models.
No. Not unless you want to start imposing some statistics on the quantum Diamond model, and we're not.
Mm.
In fact, we want to actually focus on a boson problem.
Mm.
So the low-lying excitations can be, because of this equivalence between the classical and the quantum eigenvalues, you can then go ahead and compute the dynamic correlation functions of the classical metropolis walk that samples the exact ground state. And in that case, as long as you're sampling the exact ground state, you can then by transformation, in-house transformation, you can obtain the low-lying excitations of the quantum Hamiltonian. Okay, so now this we also have working, but I won't give any results for this this morning.
So this is equivalent to doing a classical Monte Carlo simulation?
Yes. Yeah.
So
it's really
not applied to these worm algorithms or things of that sort, which are perhaps more non-local, a bit useful to classical
dynamics. Right, right. Well, I'll address in the walk, we have to be careful about making, you might need to use non-local moves as well. But we specifically need the local moves for
sure.
The Diamond problem. So in fact, so far we haven't, just for the ground state, we haven't needed to use any non-local moves. For the excited states, we may need to, and we're sure that when we go to quantum Monte Carlo, when we're going to have to use a full propagator to do the dynamics, then we'll have to use something that will work. Okay, so here's the system which we're looking at for the calculations. It's a de-isotopic quantum loop gas in the triangular lattice. So we have fully packed triangular coverings, and this is our reference. So there's a background dimerization of red bonds, and those together with the dimers, which are shown in black, form transition graphs, which are the loops. And so we are looking at fully packed loop coverings. And the dimers, another reference point is if you have a dimer living on a red bond, that's the minimal loop of length 2. Okay, so those are the shortest loops that we can make on this lattice. Okay, so again, this is the dimer representation corresponding to the Hubbard system of Friedman, Knight, and Schlegel. So the dynamics that we're considering are summarized here. So the first three here are plaquette flips of dimers. And the last, number three here is a three-dimer move, and number four is a four-dimer move. And the three different plaquette flips correspond to an isotopy condition here, where there's no change in number of loops. de-isotopy condition here, that's number two, and also the three and four diamond moves are also de-isotopic. And then the last plaquette move up on the top here, which we call zero, is a move which will disconnect loops and reconnect them differently, and that's what we call what's called a surgery move. So in order to simulate the diamond model, the surgeries are forbidden. In order to simulate the quantum loop gas, the surgeries are forbidden. And the three and four diamond moves are required in order to have a good density in a single winding sector. And we're making calculations in the zero winding sector for simplicity, but it's one of, so we're looking at the single ground state in the zero winding sector, which thermodynamic limit then is degenerate with all the other winding sectors for the loop gas. Okay, so then this is a Hamiltonian that corresponds to these moves, and you see here we've got these weighting factors on the potential terms of the de-isotopy, and this Hamiltonian is related, it's derived from the Hamiltonian originally put down by Friedman and Schengel. And what we then do is we fine-tune this Hamiltonian to the RK-type line of the loop gas Hamiltonian by setting the amplitudes T and V equal, and then the zero-energy ground state is a de-isotopic quantum loop gas. And that gives us then a nice one-parameter class of Hamiltonians where D is the parameter that we're going to vary, and we're going to look at the characterization of the ground state then of these systems. Note that D is 1, if we add these surgeries, which are these zero plaquette loops, that corresponds to the, put the surgeries back in, that corresponds to the RK point of the pure diamond model on the triangular lattice. But without the surgeries, we have just the quantum loop gas. Okay, and then lastly, the parameters epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 are smallness parameters. These are the parameters that we put outside here, multiplying the 3 and 4 diamond moves here, which we expect to be small, and these will not affect the ground state, although they will affect the excited states. Okay, so what do we do? It's really right now, what we've done so far has been quite straightforward. Mainly a question of bookkeeping and getting all the plaquettes and the basis set properly categorized. We're doing metropolis sampling as a ground state wave function, and for this, the loop, if we take just the pure loop dynamics without the surgeries, they are critical, and so this is very inefficient. And so then we add, so first thing we do here is we add surgeries back on, and so that gives us efficient sampling of the ground state. And we could also add non-local moves, but so far for the ground state we found that this is sufficient, okay, to make efficient sampling. And then the line excitations can be extracted from the dynamic correlation function. What one does here, one has the surgeries on for efficient sampling, and then when you want to collect the correlation function data for averaging, then one turns the surgeries off. So you sort of have one continuous walk, and you have surgeries on for equilibration, and then you switch them off when you're collecting data. And that seems to work quite well. Now I'll show you some results. So first of all, some global properties. The first thing to look at is the distribution of loop lengths in these systems. So on the left, you see this is just the average loop length, so it's a highly average quantity. As a function of the de-isotopy parameter, little d, in three calculations of corresponding to different matter sizes, we're using periodic boundary conditions in two dimensions here. So actually the solid line 4 is obtained by exact diagonalization, right? And the other ones are the metropolis sampling. So firstly, just technically, it looks as if this global quantity is converging quite nicely with the system size from 16 to 18. This is converging quite fast. Then what do we see here? Well, we see a general, a very broad, transition from this is projected in my Macintosh machine. I should have known, right? It's the wrong place to bring a Mac. general transition from long, from the long loops or an average long loop at short small values of d to shorter loops on average as d has increased. And this is in accordance with what we expect from all the theoretical work of Friedman, Mack, and Spengel, because we really were looking actually for a sharp transition at square root of 2, where there would be, you know, the transition between critical and non-critical behavior. But in these finite size systems, so we're seeing something that's really broadly smeared out, but we can certainly say that from 2 onwards, the loops are very small indeed. And then secondly, we can look at where these loops are, these short loops, and they are, as we expect, after looking at Hamiltonian a little bit, they are indeed in the short loop region up here, small d. It's mainly d, in fact, it's nearly 100% of the red bonds that are occupied. And when you have short loops, remember I told you that the dimers on a red bond gives you the minimal loop of length 2. And so these are what is dominating up here at large d values. And then it's only when one gets down, even when one's down to the smaller d values of the order of 1, one still has by the time one gets down to 1, one has basically an equal population of red and black, which is what you expect when you have very, very long loops in the system. Okay, so this is a global property. It behaves as we expect, but it's really too highly averaged to give us the kind of detailed insight into the system that we want. So we'll look at a little bit, in the next slide, we'll look at something more detailed about the loop length. But first, the other general quantity we compute in the ground state is are the correlation functions, dimer correlation functions. And these tell us about to what extent the system is ordered or disordered. And so what I've shown here is one of these correlation functions. It's a parallel dimer, so it's dimers which are parallel to each other, starting from a red site, dr, and then going out along the axis with parallel orientation of the dimers as a function of little r. So the reference point here is that there's an alternation of red and black bonds going out in the direction r. The red bonds here would be occurring at distances 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on. And the first thing, so what she's shown here is this correlation function for several values of little d, and the small values of little d are at the bottom here, and then these peaks, which you see at the positions 2, 4, and 6, start to rise and increase in intensity for the larger values of d. So what we're seeing here is that there's residual ordering on the red bonds, and it's becoming stronger as the DSLP parameter becomes larger. And this is, again, is consistent, it's basically built into that Hamiltonian from the DSLP condition. It's consistent with the DSLP condition of d weight for when you make an extra loop, and as d gets larger and larger, that weighting becomes more and more significant. So it gives us residual ordering, which increases in intensity. Then in terms of the actual ordering of the system intrinsically, what we look at here are the correlations to the black bonds. And we see that there are no correlations, essentially no correlations from the red to the black bonds, even in the distances where finite black occupation persists. So in other words, at low values of d, where we know that we have long loops and that there's a strong occupation of a relatively strong occupation of dimers on the black bonds, that there's essentially no correlation, no spatial correlation between them. So that tells us that, as expected from the archaic behavior on the triangular lattice, that the system at the ground state is disordered. Okay, so now back to the loop statistics. Okay, so what we've done here to get a little bit more insight is to compute the fraction of dimers on a loop of a particular length L. So one of the nice things about this program is once you're computing this, then it's a question of how clever you can be to compute the right correlation functions or the right average quantities. And this is still something which is averaged, I'll tell you in a moment what we're trying to calculate next, but this is something that now breaks, it's average, but it breaks down the distribution of dimers into the distribution of loops into contributions from short and long, and looks at them individually. So we have here, we see here that the large values of D, that's the yellow line here, that's one reference here. For large values of D, the fraction of dimers on a particular loop really is nearly localized around short loops, and it decays very fast. It's an exponential decay. In fact, there's an exponential decay on all of these at short loop lengths. And then there's very few dimers on the longer loops, as we saw before. But now as we increase D, we see that this fraction exponential decrease of short loops is followed by the emergence of a, first of all, of a shoulder, and then as D decreases further, of a plateau, which is spread out over a large range of length scales. If you look at the actual sizes here, so this is actually normalized to the total number of particles, but these length scales become quite large. And then thirdly, we see that for the very smallest values of D, there appears to be a peak at the end here, Gaussian type of peak. And this peak, I'll analyze it here, but we think this is the boundary effect, which goes away if we go to larger systems. So we have to investigate that in more detail. Okay, so generically what we're seeing is that there is an exponential decay of short loop contribution, and that then there's a broad plateau of a significant range of length scales, several orders of magnitude. And that, again, is consistent with this intermediate D values between 1 and square root of 2, that's from 1 to the turquoise to the red curves here, being critical. On the right here, okay, so it's showing the same quantity, but now for one fixed value of D, D is 1.4, so that's the red data here, but now for three different system sizes. So with this, we can look a little bit at the finite size effects, and we see here that this Gaussian peak does reduce and appears to become smoothed out as the system becomes larger and larger, and while the relative position of this peak, is moving in as the system size becomes larger, if you then take away the normalization and actually look at the absolute position of this peak, it is actually moving out as the system size becomes larger. So it's scaling as it should do for a boundary effect in a finite system. So we're planning to carry out these calculations for axes of up to several hundred by several hundred to really check that that's is indeed what it appears to be in the boundary effect. Okay. Then we can, okay, so here's a little bit more detailed analysis of this. So Chris checked that for all small d values, this short peak is indeed well fit by an exponential. So we can fit this and we can subtract the contribution of the short loops from the dimer fraction distribution. And then we obtain the plot shown here, so which now summarizes just the D dependence of the fraction of dimers in, quote, long loops. And again, there's a reasonable convergence, at least at these sizes, with the system size. And the generic behavior is consistent with what we saw on the previous slide, namely that for large values of D, there are virtually no long loops. Everything is short loops. And then there's this gradual increase of the long loops below about 1.8. Again, one of the things we were looking for was whether there was a sharp transition. Doesn't seem to be a sharp transition in this is our first set of data, essentially. And one thing I think we need to see, but we need to do somewhat larger sizes and see whether this is really shifting over or what the finite size effects on this are. And this just shows the width of the exponential. And so what you see here is that a small values of D, and this is being controlled by the pseudo-Boltzmann weight factor. And then the larger values of D, this is the width is dying off, the intensity is going up, and it just tells you that the same as this essentially zero contribution of the long loops here. everything's going into the short loops. The short loop peak is becoming narrower and more intense. Okay, so those are really all the numerical results we have as of this morning. And then, where are we going with this? So these are some of the things we're computing now and plan to, in the near future, move on to. Firstly, okay, the next immediate thing is to look at intra-loop correlation functions. And these should just give us some information about the critical exponents and how we can relate them to some classical critical exponents there. The factor dimension might also be relevant there and of interest. Then we want to, we actually already are doing the imaginary time dynamics, and that will give us the excitations, and we can look at the dispersion of the excitations and the nature of the gap and so on. So we'd like to test the consistency with conjectured SU2 gauge theory, and if anyone has ideas about how to actually do that explicitly, we'd be very happy to discuss it with you. That's not so obvious how one would actually check that those excitations have SU2 symmetry. Not in from a simulation. Then, as I indicated before, we're adding perturbations. We want to add perturbations to the Hamiltonian, then we'll have to use quantum Monte Carlo, and so there we're probably going to be using some form of variational path integral, and we may have to include non-locals for this. So that will enable us to look at neighboring phases, ground and inside states, and to really probe whether there are these proximal topological states. Other things one can do, which may not seem immediately relevant, but might give rise to some interesting changes, are to look, for instance, at the effects of disorder, which is easily done. In particular, does disorder restore the criticality for larger d-values, d-values above root 2, maybe even above 2. And also one can, in principle, use this technique to look at other loop models. Okay, so that's everything on the quantum Monte Carlo. So now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the work of Jan Korsbach from now, work on the other representation of this quantum loop gas model proposed by Chetan, Michael, and Kirill, which is the extended Hubbard model they proposed with this Hubbard-type Hamiltonian here, which is now a Hubbard model for particles which are localized on the sites of the surrounding lattice, which is this Kagame lattice which is described here. So let me just explain. So the triangular lattice we were dealing with was obtained by taking the centers of each hexagon and connecting them, and then you get this triangular lattice. And when there are two centers of hexagons are connected by a red point here, that's what gave us the red dimers on the background covering the triangular lattice. And if they're not connected by red, then they were black on the triangular lattice. So the red colors here denote the centers of the dimers from the red sites, and all other dimers would be black. Okay, so if we look at this Hubbard Hamiltonian, it does have this generic Hubbard form of chemical potential term, an on-site repulsion with strength U0, another repulsion with a different strength U, which is between particles which are on the same sites of one hexagon. And then there's an interaction labeled B, which is another Hubbard interaction between particles which are on the opposite sides of a bow tie. A bow tie is this combination of two triangles joined at a vertex. And that's sort of the bow ties lie between the hexagons. And then here's the Hubbard hopping term, which takes particles from one hexagon to adjacent sites only. So now the one critical one important feature about this Hamiltonian when thinking about implementing it physically is that it's required that there be a hierarchy of strengths of U0 being very, very large, and U0 can be safely set to be infinity, so we have no two particles on the same side. But then there's an order of magnitude difference between the interaction U, which is a hexagon interaction, two-particle interaction, and the V, which is the bow tie inter-particle interaction. These are both repulsive interactions, so it's certainly an extended Hubbard type of model. But if you try to think about implementing this, the first thing you might think about is putting electrons on the side in some solid state, situation on the camera lattice. And then you see you're not going to get anywhere because the distances from here to there across the hexagon are the same as the distances along the bow tie. So any kind of interaction which is based on a Coulomb interaction is not going to give you the right scaling of the repulsive images. So you need to have some scheme of implementing interactions which are highly anisotropic, in particular which are symmetry dependent according to your location of the lattice. Also with very specific ranges, because you also want these interactions to then switch off after you go from one corner of a bow tie to another. You don't want to then have a long range interaction which causes a particle from this hexagon to interact with a particle from that hexagon. So if you can't use electrons in solid state, then you know it seemed obvious to think about using some kind of artificial solid state like an optical lattice, where there's a high degree of control available, and you can put neutral atoms or molecules in. And so we've been investigating these, and I'll show you two schemes that we've looked at. One that is based on atoms, which has some nice elements, but also has some big disadvantages. And then the other one based on molecules, which seems to be working a lot better. Okay, so now you see it, now you're done. All right. So this is a summary of the neutral atom implementation. So the basic idea is that we have that every site is filled by a particle, and we use the internal states of atoms to code for the presence of a particle or a vacancy in the Hubbard Hamiltonian. Okay, the internal states can be addressed by lasers, and we can certainly very easily switch from one state to another. So that allows one to do effective tunneling, atom switching places. And so here the black and the red and the green are the sites on the optical lattice. And then the gray I'll tell you about in a moment, and the purple in the middle also I'll tell you about in a moment. Okay, so that's straightforward. Now we consider how to implement the interactions across the hexagon and across the bow tie. So the nice thing that one can do here is one can make some auxiliary sites. And so for instance, this big lilac thing in the middle of a hexagon is an auxiliary site where, okay, so one has to superimpose another optical lattice field to generate a potential well here, and particles can tunnel from these Kagame lattices into this central site here. And this tunneling can be made state selective by addition of more lasers, and then one can engineer an effective interaction between a particle on this site and the opposite site by, in a higher order population, by tunneling to the center of the hexagon. Then there's an energy penalty for both of them to tunnel together, and that gives you an effective repulsive interaction. So one can, then we do something similar with the bow tie interaction, and we replace these auxiliary sites above all of the particles, and then again there's an energy penalty for both particles on the opposite end of the bow tie to tunnel to the center, and this can be tuned to be an order of magnitude less than the repulsive interaction for co-tunneling to the site in the center of the hexagons. So with this scheme, you can certainly generate the difference in order of magnitude of these repulsive interactions. However, there are problems. In particular, a big problem is leakage, because you have states in Hilbert space that correspond to the two particles being on this auxiliary site that you don't want to have in the Hamiltonian. And they're actually fairly significant when you do calculations. You see that there's an appreciable population on these auxiliary sites. So leakage is a big problem. And the second problem is that the virtual interactions by these auxiliary sites are rather weak, because you're making use of, you're relying intrinsically on the interparticle, the inter-site tunneling, and on the repulsive interactions on a single site. So these two problems together convinced us that this couldn't really go not to the point of realization. But there are two features that I want to keep from this model, which are very attractive for this system. One is this representation of atoms and vacancies in the Hubbard Hamiltonian by internal states. That makes it actually very easy to put a defect into the lattice, because you can just take the atom and put it to a third state, C, and then it's outside the helmet space relevant to the Hubbard helmetopia, and you essentially created a defect that could be used to create excitations. And you do this without actually destroying the lattice. So that's an attractive feature. And then the other attractive feature is the use of these auxiliary sites to engineer these interactions of different symmetry either across a hexagon and across a bow tie. Okay, so keeping these features, we then, okay, so last year, Peter Solomon's group had this very nice paper where they showed that you have a really powerful way of having controlled interactions between dipolar molecules in optical lattices. And in this scheme, the molecules are localized. So that's that enables one to get rid of this problem of leakage due to tunneling and co-tunneling. So this is the scheme of Toller and his group. We're using localized molecules, diatomic molecules in the first instance with having a permanent dipole moment, one net electron spin. And what they showed was that you can create effective spin-spin couplings between electronic spin of the two molecules through intramolecular spin rotations, a combination of intramolecular spin rotation and intermolecular dipole-dipole coupling. And I think Peter will probably say a lot more about this, so I'll just go through the parts relevant to us very quickly. So basically, for a single molecule, one has rotational energy and spin orbit coupling. So two molecules will then develop the dipole-dipole coupling of this form, which couples the rotational states. And in the ground state, there's no net dipole moment. There's only a very weak intrinsic dipole-dipole interaction, 1/r^6. But if one considers virtually exciting one of the pair of molecules so you get to the end of the subspace with one unit angular momentum, then you have an interaction of this form here, which can be made much larger because it depends on the spin-orbit coupling induced by the nature of the effective laser-induced spin-spin coupling, which depends on the laser intensity, so it's controllable. So then one obtains an interaction of the order 1/r^3, which can be tuned to different energies and it's framed with laser tuned close to some level of n is 1. Okay, so you can put your laser at a particular energy difference here, from the ground state to one of these higher lying levels there, and you can select out that way excitations at a particular distance. So you can choose selectively to excite, to cause an interaction between two molecules that are a particular fixed distance apart, just by choosing the appropriate choice of the energy and also the polarization of the lasers. Okay, so here then is a summary, and Peter will probably give more details of this, but here's a summary of what components of that would be useful for realizing the extended Hubbard model. So now we're going to keep our representation of particle and vacancy by different internal states of a particle, but now our particle is a diatomic molecule on these sides, and we're looking at the different internal spin states of the electron on the dipolar molecule. Then tunneling can be induced, so then we just go to the table of interactions in Toller and his group of papers, and we see that a spin swap can be affected by an SYSY type of interaction, SYSY plus SCSC. And here on this diagram, actually the axis out of the plane is the x-axis, and z is the axis between the molecules, and y is the other axis inside the plane. So we can affect the tunneling in the Hubbard-Hamiltonian through a YY plus CZ type of spin swap, which is doable in terms of lasers. And the repulsive interactions through the particles can be affected through this kind of SXSX plus single SX interactions. And this works well. So what's shown here are radii around the central spin on a given site. Radii corresponding to interactions between this particle here and the other particles on the hexagon. And so you have one d- distance are into neighbor distance here, which gives you the interaction between a particle and its nearest neighbor on the hexagon, and you'd have to tune the lasers such that the strength of that interaction is then equal to the strength of the interaction between this particle and then a particle on the hexagon site one further away, which is indicated by the yellow circle. And then similarly with then a third laser, which would couple you to the particle off on the opposite side of the hexagon. So this works fine, but then one has a small problem, which is that the distance across the hexagon is the same as the distance, again, over the bow ties, as I mentioned earlier on. So one has to again be able to distinguish between a hexagon interaction and a bow tie interaction. And the way to do this, Young worked out, is to, again, to add spins on the auxiliary side. And the reason this works in this case is that all these interactions, which are interactions between like molecules on these sites, are all permutation symmetric. And in order to, and what we do here, by adding a molecule at an auxiliary site, we create a non-symmetric interaction, which gives an energy penalty when two particles are on this hexagon and raises the energy of those two particles because of their interaction by this central molecule here. And this has to be a non-symmetric interaction. And that means that one has to use a different molecule in the auxiliary site than on the hexagons. Okay, but that again, that seems doable. That's the point at which we are now, and we have to actually now sit down and choose some molecule and actually make some quantitative calculations for this. But this is encouraging in the sense that it does indicate that, you know, trapped atoms or preferably molecules in optical lattices, one has the flexibility of engineering these very artificial types of interactions which appear in the Hubbard-Hamilton. So, this is all I have to say. Let me just summarize. So what I've outlined to you is the first stage of our numerical calculations here, which are the first stage of which is to make quantum loop gas simulations with classical Monte Carlo techniques, which we at the generalized are K points. And ground state loop properties are very easily accessible. Excitations are also fairly straightforward and they're in progress. The extension to perturbed quantum loop gases can be made with quantum Monte Carlo, and that's also underway. And lastly, I've described some ideas for implementing the extended Hubbard approximation to this lattice quantum loop gas with trapped dipolar molecules.